Welcome to Banyan Books, Branches of Wisdom, celebrating the joy of bright ideas and heartful lifelong learning. Branches of Wisdom is a series of intimate conversations with the world's most influential authors and visionaries. We explore spirituality and the human mind, ecology and culture. Most episodes are recorded with a live audience. You can join our live events and submit questions to your favorite guests. Check out our upcoming schedule at banyan.com. Since 1970, Banyan Books has been a rich oasis at the crossroads of wisdom and philosophy, offering resources for humanity's evolving paths. We're a locally owned, independent bookstore in the heart of Vancouver's Kitsilano neighborhood. Visit us in person or shop online at banyan.com. Please subscribe, follow, like, and leave your reviews for the podcast. And now, enjoy.
Hello and welcome. My name is Jacob Steele, the events manager for Banyan Books and Sound. Today, we are delighted and honored to be hosting David Hinton in conversation with Norman Fisher on David Hinton's new book, The Way of Chan, Essential Texts of the Original Tradition. I'd like to begin by acknowledging that although we have participants joining from around the world for these online events, the physical location of Banyan Books is on the unceded territory of the Coast Salish peoples, including the territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh nations. Donations to Banyan Books helped support these programs to be free for all. Just click on the PayPal link in the YouTube show notes below to donate. For those in our live audience, David Hinton and Norman Fisher welcome your questions. Please type questions into the chat box at any point during the event. And now for introductions. David Hinton has published numerous books of poetry and essays and many translations of ancient Chinese poetry and philosophy, all informed by an abiding interest in deep ecological thinking. This widely acclaimed work has earned Hinton a Guggenheim Fellowship, numerous fellowships from NEA and NEH, and both of the major awards given for poetry translation in the United States, the Landon Translation Award from the Academy of American Poets and the Penn American Translation Award. Most recently, Hinton received a Lifetime Achievement Award by the American Academy of Arts and Letters. Norman Fisher is a Zen teacher, poet, translator, and director of the Everyday Zen Foundation. A beloved figure in the Buddhist world, he's also well known for his efforts at interreligious dialogue. His numerous books include The World Could Be Otherwise, What is Zen, and Training in Compassion. Today, David and Norman will be in conversation about David Hinton's new book, The Way of Chan, Essential Texts of the Original Tradition. The Way of Chan illuminates the true story of Chan, or Zen, Buddhism's historical development in China. It has been described by Roshi Joan Halifax as opening the doors to the heart of Zen. The book is available from Banyan, and you can learn more about David's work at davidhinton.net and about Norman's work at everydayzen.org. It's a great honor to have them both here today. Please welcome David Hinton and Norman Fisher.
Hi, David.
Hi, Norman. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, no, my pleasure. Thanks to Jacob and Banyan. I've been having so much fun reading the book. It's, as I was saying earlier before we got on, it's sort of awakening me to something I was thinking about at the very beginning of my practice and have not been thinking about for many decades. So if it's okay with you, I'd like to just jump in and I'd like to quote a paragraph from the book and ask you to comment. And this is really, really, to me, this is so important. And it's something that I have felt myself about Zen or Chan. So here's what you say on page 7 in your introduction. Chan isn't so very difficult. You just need to understand a constellation of concepts and spend enough practice time, meditation, to see how those concepts work. but it can seem impossibly difficult for us because the conceptual framework that defines Chan practice has been misconstrued in English, making Chan as a whole into a seemingly inaccessible system of paradox and abstraction, which I think a lot of people think of Chan that way. Mm-hmm. That changes once the concepts are understood clearly. Then, rather than the seemingly impenetrable and abstract Zen perplexity, in quotes, that we generally encounter, and that was essential to the popularization of Zen when it was introduced into America during the 50s and 60s, we find, and this to me is the crux that I want to ask you about, we find empirically based depths and earthy mystery that are accessible and readily practiced in daily life. So you seem to be saying that Chan is not a mystery, and yet at the same time, there's really something here that practice in daily life. And you use the phrases empirically based depths and earthly mysteries. And it's those phrases and your sense of Chan and how we can practice it that I want to ask you about to begin with.
God. All right. Yeah, you told me you were going to talk about this, but now that you asked me, that's the whole book or all my books.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Yeah.
let's see, how do you start? I mean, to back up to earlier in that passage, when Zen started getting popular in the US in the 50s and 60s, that was like a cultural moment when people were very much into anti-intellectualism, anti-rationalism, because they blamed that sort of imperial male ego self for all of the ills in the world, like the Vietnam War and racism and sexism and all of that. So Zen, the way Zen was presented by Suzuki and Watts was fit right in with that. And it's interesting to go back and read them. I still think they're among the best writers about Zen. When I was reading books for doing all the reading for this book and for the China Root, the book before this, it kind of lays out the conceptual framework. I thought those Suzuki and Watts, even though they're long in the past now, were maybe the best that there were. But you read them and it really is a cultural moment, because over and over and over and over and over again, they will end arguments or settle discussions simply by saying something that makes no sense, quoting a koan. And that's enough. That was enough for that cultural moment. And that kind of stuck. And I just think that's not really what Chinese Chan was about. There is, it's about, you know, it really grows out of Taoism, and Taoism is about, Tao is essentially the cosmos or the earth seen as a generative tissue that's constantly changing. That's, you know, Taoism is about change. I Ching is the classic of change. And what spiritual practice was about for the Taoist, and it's no different for Chan, it's just refined and expanded, is about integrating consciousness with that, that essentially that female tissue of reality. So that's kind of challenging. That involves essentially getting past this self that we all have that feels radically separate from everything around us. So that's, and part of that self is language, and language is meaning, is sense, meaning making, is sort of rationality. That's all part of the separation. So that's where the mystery happens, is when you're trying to dissolve, that sort of conceptual scaffolding of the self. Once you dissolve it, yeah, you're into something. I'll call it mystery or perplexity or something. But in Chinese texts, are, so that's true. That's what practice is about. It involves mystery. It's earthy. But Chinese texts, although they're about that, they are sentence by sentence, they make clear sense. And translators haven't insisted on that in the past. They've thought, well, if I can't make, and but Chinese is extremely difficult, has lots of ambiguity. So translators have like encounter a sentence, if it doesn't make immediate sense, they've been very willing to say, well, that's because it's Zen. That's because it's Chan, and Chan doesn't make sense. And then you get a bad translation, But you need to keep, like any translation, you need to keep pushing the grammar and the pushing the sentence until you make sense out of it. It isn't that Chinese doesn't make sense, or that a Chan text doesn't make sense sentence by sentence, paragraph by paragraph. It's that they're talking about that earthy mystery and the idea of dismantling the ego, the self, our all of our conceptual frameworks, including Buddhism and including Chan.
Mm-hmm. Let me see if I got that, because I think this is really important. And I completely agree that we can study Chan texts, we can read them, we can understand them, we can discuss them, and we don't have to fall back on ineffability. So mm-hmm. conceptually, it can be fairly clear, but where the practice comes in is to make those concepts physical and embedded in our lives and in our practice, so they're not just in our head.
Right.
They become realized within our body and mind through the practice. So it's not as if, we read the Chan text, we understand them, end of story. No, mm-hmm. that's the end of the story. And yet we can read and understand the Chan texts, but practice is required. But when you say empirically based depths, what do you mean when you use the word empirical there?
Well, okay, so let's imagine you walk out into a field and you want to know what's empirically true. And a way to do that is to start forgetting. And it, you know, like old Taoists and Chan people, forgetting is one way of talking about meditation. So start forgetting, forget everything you know, all of your certainties, all of our culture's certainties, dismantle it all. And that's essentially what the Chan project it was. Close your eyes, do all of that dismantling so you've forgotten everything you think you know about the world and you want to know, okay, what's empirically, immediately true? Open your eyes and what do you see? Mm. First, you see wonder of wonders, there's stuff here. Why would I expect stuff to be here if I've dismantled everything? Okay, there's all this stuff here. That's presence. But the next thing that you see, you notice, if you sit there for 5 seconds or 5 minutes or 5 million years, is that stuff doesn't hold still, that it moves, it's generative, it's always changing, always bringing new things. That's the Tao. That's the perpetually, the female, perpetually generative nature of things. It's just in the nature of things, like gravity is in the nature of things. There can't be an explanation for it. You can't ask the why question any further than that. Mm. Just like gravity. That's what I mean by empirically based. And then the next step is meditation is empirically based. You can sit and watch what's going on in the mind, and you can watch that one. Oh, I can watch my thoughts going. This is pure empiricism or phenomenology. So I'm not my thought. I'm something separate from my thoughts. And your thoughts and your memories, that's the ego center. That's the self that separates you from everything else. So this is all, it's almost scientific observation, this whole thing. Mm-hmm. And if you sit there for a little longer, you realize, oh, my mind is working just like that world I saw in the field. That is, it's always changing. There, thoughts keep coming out of nothing. going through their evolution, vanishing into nothing, new thoughts, just going and going, just like the cosmos, just like this world, this field where clouds come and go and wind comes and goes and flowers come and go. So that's what I mean by empirically based. Yeah. It's all direct observation. And, you know, the the word that everyone knows as kensho, that's the Japanese word for one of the two words for enlightenment. That word in Chinese, it simply means seeing your nature, seeing original nature. That is what I just described, empirically seeing that you are essentially empty, that you are part of this ongoing generative nature of things.
Yeah, isn't that character, I think you show this in the book, isn't that character for nature have the element of mind and then birth, like the arising of mind? Isn't that what that character implies? In other words, seeing how the mind arises and passes away like everything. That's the nature.
Yeah, well, that's the other word for enlightenment, which is the word that literally means awakening. But then the kensho word is actually two words, and it's just literally seeing nature.
Yeah. And you know, when I asked you about the word empirical, because the word I usually use, which sounds like you're using the word empirical, and would you, I don't see what you think of this. The word that I am more used to using and seems closer to my way of feeling the practice is immediate.
Yeah, I use that word a lot too. Right.
Without any mediation, no mediation by thinking or understanding, but immediate. So empirical and immediate would be equivalents here, more or less, in terms of what we're
talking about. I think so. Yeah. For me,
that's very beautiful. Also, it's very encouraging for older people who are forgetting anyway. You know, the more we forget, the closer we are to the truth. Excellent. I like that. It's very good.
Forgetfulness is such a blessing, because the more you forget, the less there is to
get to work. Right. Well, you know, it's wonderful that. This event, I was invited to participate with you in this event because just this month in our Dharma seminar, we've been actually, in a way, studying exactly what you've been studying all this time. We've been studying environmentalism, connection to the earth, through reading a fascicle of Dogen called Valley Sounds, Mountain Colors. And we've been getting into how, like what you just said, how mind and world are the same phenomenon, and they're not different. So there's no environment in which we are living in the foreground and the environment is the space in which it's taking place. No, we are the environment. The environment is us. There's just one seamless whole. And that's been, I think that's behind that idea is embedded in Taoism /Chan, as you see it, and in all your work. So I'm going to read another very short passage this time and ask you another question about that. And this one appears on page.
Before you do that, I'd be interested to hear how you all were talking about that.
Well, we're reading along in Dogen's fascicle, the one I just mentioned, Valley Sounds, Mountain Streams, in which he basically says, you know, the whole earth and the whole mind is one seamless reality in every moment.
Mm-hmm.
There's no separation. And it's you know, you could say that our long ago as Western culture, separating ourselves from the environment and seeing the environment as something for our use, something that we can make use of to improve our lives,
right?
That very philosophical, sort of emotional, psychological distancing from the environment is what led us down this path of not seeing what we were doing until now, when it's practically too late.
Yeah, that's what my whole Wild Mind book is about. Wild Mind.
Exactly. In fact, we're reading Wild Mind in that's on our reading list.
So what do you do for practice? So you get that idea, and what do you do with it in your center or with your center?
It's not that we do anything different with it. I mean, basically, we understand that idea is embedded in what Zazen is.
Uh-huh.
So we're sitting in zazen, we understand that's what we're doing. We're not doing meditation. We're not observing our minds. We're not sitting there to improve ourselves or understand ourselves better. We're sitting there to shed our separation from one another, because it's also, that's why social justice and environment are not two separate issues. Same issue. When we realize we ourselves and everything and everyone are one phenomenon, then naturally we're aware and we're kind to one another and to the earth that is our life. So for example, I was saying in one of my Dharma talks that when Buddha touches the earth, you know, that's the moment when the Buddha's awakening opens up, because Mara says, here's all these things, you know, greed and desire and guilt and all these things. These are my minions to prevent you from awakening. What are your minions? And the Buddha touches the earth and says, I am the earth. The earth is me. And that is why you, Mara, will never be able to defeat me, because we are this. And so we sit in zazen, you know, with that spirit and that understanding, and that it's a very, very, like you say, the fact that it's feminine is so very beautiful, because it means it's fully accepting, it's forgiving, it's gentle, it's always kind. So we're sitting in zazen with that spirit and trying to cultivate that spirit in our living, you know, in our way of living on the planet and living with one another. Yeah. So it's, you know, because, you know, we were looking for a way to examine and feel our way into environmentalism and working with climate change that wasn't just the usual tech fixes and political hand-wringing. You know, those things are, of course, necessary, but we wanted to find a religious and spiritual, more authentic human way of entering this conversation. And so that's what we've been doing. And finding zazen is that. So sit in meditation is that.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's what I do in Wild Mind, Wild Earth, is that I think you're right in that you can have all the technological fixes, but you have to have the right approach, the right framework.
Yeah.
To use them. Otherwise, if you don't value earth and animals as something other than just what their use is for us, you're not gonna, no matter how much technological power you have, you're not gonna do anything good with it.
No, and every technological fix brings unknown bad consequences, right? So here in this passage you talk about Chan and Buddhism as a spiritual practice throughout the Chinese cultural tradition, and you refer it back to the Paleolithic times in China, practice to cultivate consciousness integral to the vast and wondrous tissue of reality, to cultivate a sense of wholeness and belonging, a sense of home and kinship. And I think this is something so important in the practice, and I think it can be lost in a Buddhism that's all about taking care of our minds and understanding ourselves and improving our mental and emotional life. It leaves a whole dimension of deep kinship and belonging. And I wanted to ask you in relation to that about your own practices, because I know that you live in Vermont and you do a lot of hiking and you're in the wilderness a lot and in the country a lot. How does that work in your personal life? I mean, did you start there and that led you to Chan, or did you end up being inspired to be in the landscape by your work in Chinese language translation? Or how is that for you personally?
Yeah. Well, and I mean, I think it all happened sort of together. And I started I grew up in the West, and then like you, I was very influenced by Snyder and the idea that, you know, mountains were you know, part of poetry and part of spirituality and Zen and Taoism and all that stuff. So, yeah, so then I came here, and then I just slowly, as I worked through the Chinese stuff, saw it deeper and deeper and deeper. And kind of, you know, I think in a sense, my practice has been for all these years has been inhabiting the minds of these ancient sages and poets and Taoist philosophers, and in the last, I don't know, 5 or 10 years, Chan people, because to translate them, I really do inhabit their minds in a strange way. And yeah, so it's just the whole thing just keeps getting deeper, I guess. I don't know. I've kind of, I don't know where I came from anymore. I'm just here where I am.
Do you go out on a hike every day? Are you in
the country? We live in the country, and yeah, we certainly, I'm out for longish walks twice a day, maybe half an hour or an hour each.
Wow.
And then, you know, this is the Green Mountains, so I'll go do bigger hikes as often as I can, or long cross-country skis in the winter.
Yeah.
And yeah, and I guess, you know, that's kind of the way. It's pretty quiet. I don't see that many people. And I guess that's part of it, is living that way, which is the way the ancients lived, in their deep moments anyway. A lot of them worked as bureaucrats for part of their lives.
Right.
But not much. They didn't produce much from those times. It was the other. It was the times they were more alone in the mountains that they did their
right. Being. Confucianism for the capital, Taoism when you're in exile.
Yeah, exactly. right.
Although I think that, you know, at least as far as I'm concerned, I think we need to carry this same mind wherever we go. In other words, I think we are enriched and inspired by the countryside. I live in the country too, and we can go for walks right outside our door into the headlands of San Francisco, north of San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
I'm inspired by the ocean and the coastline.
That sounds great.
Yeah, it is wonderful. But at the same time, you know, it has to be everywhere, I think, too. It can't be, because goodness knows we have to protect. I kind of feel like we want to protect open space for its own sake, not so that we can visit it.
Yeah, right. Well, that's a big, yeah, that's a big learning, that stuff has a value for its own self-realization, not for us.
Yeah.
Is an important thing that I don't think we're going to learn in time.
Right.
What was I thinking?
While you're thinking, maybe I'll take a minute to do what Jacob asked me to do. Remind the audience that we are going to do questions in about 10 or 15 minutes. So this is a time to think about some questions if you have them, and write them down in the chat box, and then Jacob can read them to us when we're ready for that. So sorry to interrupt you. You were in the middle of something.
You were interrupting my saying nothing. No, I don't know what it was I was thinking. I mean, jumping back to the Paleolithic and the idea of Lao Tzu called. I know what I was thinking. Small hermits live in the country. Big hermits live in the city. You really do have to bring it everywhere. And the ancient Chinese did that. They really thought, if you're going to govern well, you needed to have, you needed to live in the country. You needed to spend time cultivating yourself in the way we're describing. Only once you've done that, only once you see deeply into things, can you really be to put it in our terms, a bureaucrat or a ruler.
I was always inspired by that idea, which I got from reading Gary. Gary writes about that in some of his books. Mm-hmm. And that was my idea that inspired me in the many years when I was a bureaucrat in the Zen Center, you know.
Mm-hmm.
As a leader in the Zen Center and going to a lot of meetings and stuff like that, which was not my favorite activity, but I always cheered myself up with the thought that in China, you know, poets and mystics did that. And the understanding was that, yes, you needed to have, like you just said, a view of reality that had depth to it in order to help people run society. And wouldn't it be great if we had that idea in our world now, that we expect our bureaucrats and our politicians and our corporate leaders to be people who had an inner life and a spiritual life of some depth? Wouldn't that be a different world? You know?
Yeah. There's this fantastic passage which I've translated, and it's in a book or two of mine in various places. And it's actually from one of the Confucian classics, a small one called, I forget which one it is. Anyway, it's this beautiful sequence, and it starts with, if you want to put the country at peace, put your family at peace. If you want to put your family at peace, put your mind at peace. And it goes through this sequence, and it ends, that sequence ends with sort of, if you want to put your mind at peace, you need to see deeply into things. And it's one Chinese character that means to see deeply into things. And then the whole sequence reverses. Once you see deeply into things, you put the mind at peace. Once you put the mind at peace, and it comes right back out to where it started. And it's really gorgeous. And I think totally true.
Yeah, that's another element to this too. And I think that is evidenced in your own work, because in addition to doing the Chinese classics and now some work with Chan, you also have lots of translations of Chinese poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And the relationship between these things is very clear, that you know, here in the West, we've had this big distinction between philosophy or religion on the one hand and poetry and the arts on the other hand. And in Chinese culture, it's not that way at all. Poetry, philosophy, religious life, spiritual life is one continuous practice. And so I felt this way too. I think Jacob cited, you know, mentioned one of my books, Imagination, in the Bodhisattva, the world could be otherwise. Imagination in the Bodhisattva path. Mm-hmm. The idea that spiritual practice is an imaginative practice, that the imagination is something, it's like a physical, almost like an organ, like an eye or an ear. And it's an organ of vision to see the world as it is. And we need to cultivate the imagination. And in the excessively rationalistic and scientific world, the imagination has been relegated to a kind of irrelevant position as a function that produces content for platforms to make money. That's what the imagination is. But the imagination with a capital I is right in the middle of all that we're talking about. You know, it's really all about the depths of the human imagination to conceive reality as it truly is. And that's a bigger question than simply a scientific experiment or a bunch of facts and statistics. It's a deep engagement with reality.
Right. Yeah, it really is true. The ancient Chinese poetry and painting and calligraphy are completely shaped by Chan insight and Chan Taoist and Chan insight, which are the same thing. I mean, Chan is just an extension of Tao, which is what this book is about, showing, tracing in the text and showing how Chan is not this kind of Buddhism that came from India, that it's it's Taoism, the native Chinese form of spirituality that's very earth-based, modified a little bit by the influence of Buddhism, but then just continues on as a refined version of Taoism. And that framework really shapes how Chinese poetry works. That very clear landscape imagistic poetry is there because if you meditate, you clear your mind and you empty your mind, there you are, and you open your eyes, what you see is mirror deep. So that kind of mirror deep image is awakening. And that's how Chinese poetry is built. It's built on sort of Chan awakening. And painting the same way. It's all the great painting is landscape painting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you talk about that in the book, and there's a bunch of really nice reproductions of ink painting in Chinese culture. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, what you say is, as I say, it's been eye-opening for me to think about it and read, because I guess you know that in the contemporary Zen movement in the West, your view is not the way that people look at it. The way people look at Zen as Buddhism, and when they study Zen, they often, rather than studying Chinese classics, they'll be more likely in the study of Zen, and we do this in our group too, they'll be more likely to read from the Pali Canon or the Mahayana Sutras from the Sanskrit, and, you know, to some extent bypass the Chan connection. Not that I think people do understand that there's a difference between Indian Buddhism and Chinese Buddhism. Chinese Buddhism is not simply Indian Buddhism with Chinese clothes. Going to China, Buddhism was fundamentally transformed, but that thought is sort of set to the side as we merrily go along reading our English translations from Sanskrit and Pali and so on. So I think your books, because it's not just this book, is a tremendous corrective to that and helps us to see our way back to China.
Oh, well, good. I'm glad you see that. That's what I'm hoping. Yeah, because in China, after Buddhism came, it wasn't just Chan that Buddhism didn't just turn into Chan. It also turned into all kinds of religious Buddhism, quote unquote, sort of popular Buddhism. And that stuff is more similar to the Indian Buddhism. I really think Chan is anti-Buddhist. I say this over and over. It's anti-Buddhism. If it's interested in Buddhism, it's only as a structure to dismantle, an mental structure. So often when it talks about it, it's addressing students who have come to Chan from the more popular religious Buddhist kind of training. And it's trying to like knock that stuff out of them, but it will use some of the Buddhist terminology sort of to engage them. That's one of the main reasons that you find it. But I was going to say that, I think you're right that one of the big reasons that the translation of Zen texts in the past has failed is for that very reason. And that's because translators have assumed that Chan is an extension of Indian Buddhism. So they're understanding it from the Indian Buddhist kind of perspective. And they're getting it wrong because that's just not what it's doing. That's if they face that some kind of perplexity or ambiguity and they need to resolve it, they often do it that way by how does this work in Indian Buddhism? And Indian Buddhism has a lot of metaphysics in it. And Chan and ancient Chinese have zero interest in metaphysics, zero interest in the transcendental. Everything is empirical and earth.
Yeah.
Even though they don't use those words, they use the words Tao and they use a bunch of other words.
It's really tricky, though, and this has been, you know, my kind of life's reflection. It's really tricky because just in the same way that Chan really revolutionized Buddhism and turned it inside out, similarly, here we are in our culture, right? And so we're not China, and we didn't grow up on the Tao Te Ching. We grew up on the Old Testament and the New Testament. Right? So I think that we also are going to be turning Buddhism inside out, and what I love about what you're doing, and you know, you have, I don't know how many titles, all of which, I mean, you could almost say, I think with justice, that everything that you've done, the poetry, the Chinese classics, and now this new work on Chan, is about this Chinese connection that stands behind all of the Buddhism that we're trying to practice when we're doing Zen. You're correcting us. You're giving us a body of understanding that needs to be part of whatever misunderstanding we are inevitably making, you know, and will make.
And building out forward. Yeah.
Yeah, building out forward. Yeah.
I think what's lost is so valuable. I mean, I get it that, and it's good that the West is like maybe adding its own dimensions to this whole thing, but it needs that other stuff too.
It does, and especially because of what we were saying earlier, the environmental aspects of it.
Yeah, right.
That's why it's not just a matter of it's more than let's get the Chan right and not mistake it. No, it's more than that. It's let's mm-hmm. not forget about this dimension of Chan, which is no doubt completely different from Indian Buddhism. Indian Buddhism does not have this sense of belonging and embeddedness in the earth.
Right. Not at all.
Chan, that is so essential to Chan because of the connection with Taoism. And that is what we really need in our time, in our environment.
Yeah, that's the whole idea of Chan as that was there in ancient China, and we can use now that Chan was a way informed sort of politics and social practice. And that's what could make it useful now, right?
Yeah, but I have to say, this is, it's time for us to open to questions. I have to say, this is a kind of a down note, but I was quite shocked many decades ago when I realized that, and I think this is a true fact, that in getting ink sticks to study and write about the Chinese classics that talked about we are the earth and the earth is us, the Chinese pretty much deforested their whole universe.
Yeah, because the ink sticks are made of pine ash and glue. Yeah,
exactly.
I think they were probably deforesting. Most of the deforestation probably happened for other reasons than ink sticks,
What I'm saying is that it's a sad fact that must be noted that the Chinese were not exactly, loving the forests and preserving them. The Chinese were also cutting them down, even as they had this point of view. So I think it sort of tells us that this point of view is not by itself sufficient,
right.
But it's certainly, I think, necessary.
That's what I think. Yeah, that's China's definitely devastated its environment.
Yeah.
That's what I think part of it is we now have the technological power to live without that kind of destruction if we really want to. They didn't really have it. They had a lot of people and people needed to cook their food and heat their houses and build their houses and all that stuff. And they had no other way to do it. And this worldview was the worldview only of the elite. So people out in the villages had all kinds of mélanges of Buddhism and Confucianism and animism and whatever else was around.
Well, that's the other thing too, is that I want to, in the work that I do, I'm really interested in avoiding the idea of Chan or Zen as a kind of rarefied aesthetic practice for special people. It needs to serve everyone. So to have an authentic practice of real cultivation and depth of zazen, of meditation, that is available to anyone who wants mm-hmm. to practice it, that seems really important for our time, and that's maybe some work.
I couldn't agree more. That's why I try to write books that are very as clear as and direct as possible, and I really resist the idea that this is kind of hoity-toity ambiguity and perplexity and. Because anybody can sit on a cushion. You don't have to have any money to do that.
No, and it's pretty simple practice, actually. I was saying, we had an all-day sit yesterday. I was saying, this is a pretty simple practice. There's not a lot to it. Anybody can do it. And I often say that I'm embarrassed that I've spent my life on something that is so simple that anybody can do it. And then anybody who does it is as good at it as I am on the first day, It's very embarrassing. To have no expertise at anything,
What I like about it is that if you sit, if you do Chan at deep and you at shallow levels or deep levels, you realize that you're engaging yourself or your identity, you're at a level that is a kind of universal. There's no, You kind of slip right past all the sort of racial tensions, all the differences that people want to argue about, whether it's race or religion or sex or all of those things that we spend so much time agonizing over. You sit in, that's like, oh well, we're all in the same place. Consciousness is the same for all of us, whoever we are. In fact, it even is not at that level, like, you know, all sentient beings have this basic conscious structure of consciousness, certainly mammals and birds. That we can identify with and be, you know, kindred with at the deepest possible level of our being.
Yeah, and it's a feeling in your body and in your breath.
Yeah.
Maybe it's a good point to see if there are any questions, and call on Jacob to look and see. Any questions over there, Jacob?
Yeah, lots of great questions. Yeah. And I just want to just say on my own behalf, it's been really eye-opening just hearing these perspectives on Chan. I just had no idea actually about some of the origins and the differences from say Indian Buddhism or how I thought of it. So there's a lot of great questions. Where should I begin? Okay, so Michael asks,
This is Chan. Why don't you read four of them all together and pretend they're one?
Okay, and then I'll make it very mysterious. Have you looked into traditional Japanese aesthetics and their correlation to Chan, and in parentheses, wabi-sabi, yugen, etc.?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to turn off my screen for a second while David speaks to that, okay?
Okay. Anyway, well, the relation to Chan is direct, and the reason is Japan, Chan, like the famous sixth patriarch was around 700. So Chan was pretty fully developed by 700 or so CE. And the century two after that, the Japanese, sort of realizing that they were a pretty backward culture, basically some enlightened emperors there sent armies of scholars, artists to China, and they picked up Chinese culture wholesale, everything. The philosophy, all of the art forms, and Chan, and in fact, the language itself. And they brought it back to Japan, and that was the basis of Japanese culture. So everything in Japanese culture is built on classical Chinese culture. So, you know, like I was talking about how Chinese poetry is built on immediate landscape images. Well, then think about haiku. That's a kind of distillation of that Chinese idea. And if you look at Chinese painting, it's very similar to Japanese painting is very similar to Chinese painting. It's generally landscape based, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the kind of, and like I said, all of the Chinese arts, poetry, philosophy, and calligraphy are all built on Chan insight and practice. And you know, all the poets, the painters, they would talk about, and the calligraphers would talk about their art as Chan practice or Chan teaching explicitly. So that's all of that got passed to Japan, and then Japan kind of refined it and made it into a different, into its own culture.
Yeah, and that's kind of a subtle and interesting thing, the difference between, because Zen, Japanese Zen, is 100% based on Chan and is Chan. And at the same time, if you study contemporary Chan teaching and practice and contemporary Zen teaching and practice, they're going to be different.
Yes.
There's going to be
And I don't know. The big mystery I talked about in China Root, which is the sort of conceptual introduction to the way of Chan, big mystery is where all of this Taoism got lost in the transmission from China to Japan to America. And I think it's someplace in Japan, because Suzuki, D.T. Suzuki, early in the 20th century, knew Japanese Zen inside out, and he doesn't seem to really know this stuff. You don't find it in his books. So somewhere between Suzuki and... You know, I don't know what it's interesting. It would be interesting to really, and this is a big scholarly project beyond me, but you mentioned Dogen, that your sangha is talking about Dogen. Well, Dogen learned everything in China. He went to China and practiced and studied there. So when he came back to Japan, presumably he had this stuff. He couldn't have been in China that long without learning this.
Well, he actually was only in China for 3 years. So,
well, that should be long enough. And plus the whole cultural framework he was operating in was already, what are his dates like, 11 or 1200, aren't they?
1200 to 1253.
Yeah. He's already 400 or 500 years after the importation of Chinese culture into Japan.
Right. Right.
See, just imagine, that's 400 or 500 years. That's back to Shakespeare.
Yeah.
For us.
Or well, he does quote the Chinese classics. He definitely read them, and he does quote them. But I think that
training would have been classical Chinese training even before he started doing Zen. And then he learned Zen in that kind of Chinese framework. And then he went to China for 3 years.
Right.
So he had to have heard all this or gotten all this stuff.
Yeah. I'd be interesting. There's lots of Dogen experts in the West, and I'm not one of them. But I think that he makes a distinction. In other words, he thinks that aspects of Taoism are unkosher. You know, they're not Buddhistic. I think Dogen.
Really? Well, maybe that's the beginning of it, right there.
So, I think so. So it may go back that far. Uh-huh. People who know Dogen better than I do would be able to answer. So
maybe
that.
There you go. The great Dogen got it all wrong.
Yeah, could be, or got it right, but didn't attribute it to Taoism. You know what I mean? In other words, you know how these things go, right? He may have gotten from Ru Jing, his teacher, the transmission of Zen, because he really, when he went to China, it turned him around, and he came back, and the rest of his life taught a kind of Zen that he got from China. So he may have gotten it right, but not realized that's to be credited to these sources. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It may have been just embedded in the Chan that he learned.
Right.
Well, it's funny how these things go. So in a way, for me, it's, you know, what are you practicing on the ground? Never mind so much about, you know, where you want to trace it historically, but what are you doing? You know, how is it going? That to me is the important thing. Sorry. There are more questions, I know.
More questions.
Yeah, and I wanted to just quickly throw in there for the live audience, because before you guys were live, you said something very interesting. I just wanted to tell people. So Norman was saying about kind of the beat poets and the inspiration of maybe in the West was a lot of the poetry and that kind of like artistic movement for Zen and Chan. And then David was saying that is kind of interesting parallel aesthetically. These were unified in China, the arts and the poetry. And did I say that correctly? Would you say
Yeah.
I just thought that was very interesting. There was that parallel. But okay, we'll get to another question. I'm assuming this is maybe a student of Norman's named China wrote, Norman, please tell David about asking us to write our odes and the joy and delight of sharing.
Yes. Yeah. China is in our group. Yeah. When the first week and every week of our seminar on Dogen on the environment, we've been asking people, actually one of our priests, John Evans, it was her idea to ask people to write earth odes. Mm-hmm. So every week, Sangha members chime in and write odes to the earth. And one of the most inspiring ones was written by Jean herself, which was an ode to Greta Thunberg, and it was full of kind of wonderful poetic extravagance praising Greta Thunberg, and other people have written many other odes. I actually got into this myself, and I'm writing probably a book of 100 earth odes. Of course, I quickly realized that, you know, what isn't the earth in this material life? You know, is my body not the earth?
Yeah.
Are the people that I see with my eyes and appreciate with my heart not also the earth? Mm-hmm. So that the earth odes can include everything and anything, but of course many of them include an appreciation.
Well, you know, all of your poetry isn't that sort of Wayland Zen spontaneous, the idea that everything, whatever's in front of me and whatever thoughts going through my mind is equally
right.
Interesting. Well, that's at the level of poetics, kind of everything is an earth ode.
Yes, right. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Right. Yeah. So thanks for bringing that up, China. Yeah, we have a lot of great earth odes in our Sangha.
So here's a question from Brad. What is the relationship between Kensho and, this is all hyphenated, sight clarity absolute?
Clarity absolute.
Yeah, I know what he's talking about. That sight clarity absolute is close to the way I translate a word, a Chinese word that's sort of pretty loaded philosophically. I think I call it thusness. While the biggest translation, while thusness, all clarity absolute or something. Kensho. And Kensho is seeing original. Oh, yeah. So Kensho is seeing original nature, which is seeing, you know, the nature of consciousness, the seeing the empty mind. But the other one is more seeing, and it's built on an image. It's built because, you know, Chinese ideograms are fun, built on pictograms. It's an image of an eye and a line going out from it, like it's an eye seeing straight and direct. And that's more the idea of that mirror, what I talk about as a mirror deep seeing. It's just when in empty mind, whatever you look at, you mirror exactly that as you become it, in a sense. It becomes the content of consciousness. So for that moment, you have become that. Mm-hmm. That's that sort of absolute clarity of seeing. And in the end, yeah, they are the same thing. Good question.
So we're arriving at our time, but I'll just throw in one kind of a quick, easy question, I think. Maybe okay. Not. You never know. But it's from Gillian or Jillian, and it said, are the words Chan and Zen interchangeable?
Oh. The relation of them is this. There's a Chinese ideogram, and it in China, you pronounce it Chan. Then, like I was talking about how Japan picked up Chinese culture, including the language, and brought it back to Japan and then used it to build their own culture. Well, when they did that, pretty quickly, they were pronouncing all those Chinese graphs in their own way.
Right.
So the graph, that graph in Japan is pronounced Zen. So it's just a pronunciation difference. It's the same graph. Yeah. And then, of course, as we were talking about, along with that, Chan conceptually, the whole conceptual package starts changing too in Japan. And so then you can start saying, well, there's Chan, which is this one big conceptual package, and there's Zen, which is another actually quite different conceptual package. And then it's the Zen. And then the interesting thing is, it's the Zen package that comes to America. And that's how the Taoism gets lost, because Japan is like this stopover point, even though it lasted 1,000 years or something. And then it comes to America. And that's why so much in America is Japanese terminology, even though it's all really Chinese stuff, like Kensho, like Zen, like Zazen, et cetera, et cetera. All those Japanese terms, koan, those are all really Chinese concepts, but we're in the West, in America, in the West, we think of them as Japanese, but they're not. Those are just the Japanese pronunciations of the Chinese words.
Wow. Very interesting.
Oh, there's a sort of short answer, but
it was a good answer. It was very good. So we've been talking with David Hinton and Norman Fisher. I actually just to say, I'm just really happy that we were able to bring you guys together for this event. I just feel like you guys have so much to say to each other, and
you might not have met otherwise. So thanks.
Yeah. It was a really good match. So I'm just really happy.
And it was Banyan's idea too.
Yeah. So I'm really
insight there. I don't know if it was you, Jacob. Was it you?
It was me.
Jacob, thanks.
Although I'm really happy. Maybe you guys will work together in the future or something.
Yes, we'll think of something. Yeah.
To bring the true essence of Chan to the world, to the West. So thank you so much. And it was an honor to have you both here. And thank you to the audience for all of your thoughtful questions. I wish we could get to more, but there'll be more, opportunities down the road. And just to let everybody know, you can purchase The Way of Chan and also Norman's and David's other books from Banyan at banyan.com. You can find davidhinton.net, or you can find everydayzen.org to read more about our guests. And Gassho, until next time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Pleasure.
Thanks for joining us for Branches of Wisdom, a podcast of Banyan Books and Sound, Canada's spiritual and healing resource since 1970. Our podcast producer is Jacob Steele. Watch all our conversations on YouTube by searching for Banyan Books, or listen on your favorite podcast platform. Please subscribe, follow, like, and leave your reviews and comments. We love to hear from you. For all our live events, books, and more, visit us at banyan.com.